Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In his book, The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens, Daniel Hatcher writes that the book will tell the story of how states and their human service agencies are partnering with private companies to form a vast poverty industry, turning America's most vulnerable populations into a source of revenue. We started the hour by telling you about the case of Alex, and we'll hear more about Alex, the young man who was taken into foster care at age 12 after his mother died. He didn't get any money at all, although he was entitled to Social Security survivor benefits after his father died. But the Maryland Foster Care Agency applied for the survivor benefits on his behalf and to become his representative payee. And so they took the money, and they didn't tell Alex and didn't tell him when the agency took the money for itself. Alex had a very difficult time, as many people do, getting out of the foster care system. And that is one part of the story, but there are many other parts to this story as well. Our guest writes about for-profit nursing homes sedating the elderly with psychotropic drugs in order to reduce staffing needs and maximize profits. Same kinds of drugs for children in foster care and juvenile detention facilities. Low-income defendants, this was a big story in Ferguson, as you'll recall, having to pay these huge court fines and fees, and the courts are partnering with private collection agencies, probation companies, and companies that manufacture electronic monitoring devices, all tacking on more fees to the debts owned by the poor. So we have what really is a version of debtors' prisons. He writes about an Alabama judge telling poor litigants they have to sell their blood to pay court fines or face jail time, and the list goes on. I think it's a very important book, and it's something, and we may start here, why is it that we don't pay attention to this story? Have we not known about this story? He got this story in a couple ways. One is that he is a professor of law at the University of Baltimore. He also had a first job at Legal Aid, and he represented children. And in Baltimore City, he represented those in the foster care system. So Alex was one of his clients. He represented some 300 children. Through the Freedom of Information Act, he has found out a whole lot about what's in this book, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for Daniel as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter at K Dunn Show. Daniel, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
I think it's a very, very important book, and I must say, I kept turning the pages and said to myself and then to my husband, listen to this, really, really, this is going on? And I consider myself a fairly well-informed person, but I don't know if it's just the press hasn't paid much attention to this story or if it's really hard to get the information and you had to work for a long time through Freedom of Information to get all of these stories. Why in the world don't we know a lot about this?
Right, and that's a great question, and I really think that goes towards a core part of both the problem and ultimately the solution to a lot of these practices, is that awareness matters. And for most of these practices, the reason why they have been going on, and some of them going on for a long time, that we haven't known. And regarding the foster children's benefits, where states are taking both disability and survivor benefits. Some states will take veterans assistance benefits from children whose parents died in the military. Some states will even take more. I found a regulation where Nebraska wrote a regulation where they'll even take a burial plot if a child happens to have that in his or her resources. But the states are taking resources from children without providing notice. So they'll go after survivor or Social Security benefits or disability benefits, not provide notice to the children or their lawyers, not provide notice when they apply to take over control of the money as representative payee. So no one knows, at least the people impacted by the policies have not known that this is happening. And these are the agencies that exist to protect children that are actually taking resources from children.
Tell us more about the story of Alex. I've just outlined it, but you were his lawyer.
Right. So I represented Alex in the case. We filed initially a claim, and that led into a complaint against the state of Maryland, where he came into care when he was about 12 years old in the foster care when his mother died. And then through the process being a carrier, he was shuffled around to various placements, upwards of around 20 placements, so he never had a regular placement when he was in the foster care system. They located a brother who was a potential placement resource for him, but unfortunately his brother dies. And then he had not been in contact with his father, and they located his father. And his father was going to be a potential placement resource for Alex. At least they were exploring that. And then his father dies. So, like, everybody in this poor kid's family, I mean, he's not a kid anymore, he's not an adult, but everybody in this poor kid's family is dying. And then the state, the foster care agency realizes that when the father dies, well, he's eligible for a survivor benefit, because the survivor benefits through the Social Security system are available when the parent worked, paid into the system, and earns the benefit for the child. It's a benefit that belongs to the child, much like life insurance. But the agency then applied for the benefits on Alex's behalf, didn't tell him, applied to take over control of the money as representative payee, and didn't tell him, and then took every penny of that money from Alex, and then he left care penniless, and he's struggled ever since. I've been in touch with him, stayed in touch with him since he's left care, and he's continued to struggle.
How widespread is this practice, to get whatever you can?
Unfortunately, it's very widespread, and this is just one of the practices, right, in terms of taking resources
right.
from foster children. That's happening nationwide, and an increasing number of the state agencies and the states are working with revenue contractors to help with this practice. Maryland, as an example, where I teach law school at the University of Baltimore, and where I'm also a practitioner, I teach a clinic where students represent low-income clients. Maryland has now a statewide contract with a company by the name of Maximus, who's also had some contracts in Wisconsin and surrounding states in the Midwest, where Maximus is helping now the state foster care agencies to both locate children whose parents have died, so they might be eligible for survivor benefits, and then also to seeking to increase the number of children in foster care who are determined disabled so that they would be eligible for disability benefits through the Social Security system called SSI benefits. And there, like through some of the contract documents I obtained, the company described foster children as a revenue-generating mechanism, right, which is a concern. And the numbers are really stark. They set out a goal of increasing the percentage of children in foster care who are determined disabled, where at the start at this contract process is around somewhere between 2% and 4% of the population, and they set a target of increasing that percentage to 15% to 20% of the foster care population who'd be determined disabled, not to provide any additional help for those disabling conditions or to provide additional funds for those disabling conditions, but so the state could take the money.
Why do they feel it necessary to do this? Are they short-funded somehow?
Great question, and it's both the agencies are short-funded and the states are cash-strapped, and that the, starting with the states, you know, states around the country, red states and blue states alike, have been unwilling to raise sufficient revenue through general taxation, so they're looking for money elsewhere, even these sort of behind-the-scenes mechanisms of taking aid from the vulnerable. And when the states are cash-strapped, the state agencies that serve the vulnerable populations, or state human service agencies, are even further cash-strapped. So they're engaged in this process. What's striking there is, you know, first, I don't think foster care agencies should be taking resources from children in their care, regardless. Right, but when the agencies are doing this, they're not even resulting in more fiscal capacity for the agencies, because usually states will reduce the budget layout to the foster care agencies based upon how much money the foster care agencies then take from the children.
And you also, we'll move on to other industries here in a moment, but you also remind us of what happens to so many of the foster care children who grow out of their placement. They have no money. Alex obviously left with not a penny because they took all his money. He had nothing. That they, many of them don't go to college. Actually, many of them wind up homeless. They have little chance of finding employment. Their life circumstances are pretty bleak.
Right. Unfortunately, that's absolutely correct. And we don't know a lot about former foster children because there haven't been very many studies. There actually are some decent studies that have come out of Wisconsin and surrounding areas. But what we do know doesn't look good, and Alex is an example. You know, when they're in care, foster children are struggling immensely. Foster children suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder at twice the level of Iraq war veterans. And then when these children age out of care, there aren't services in place to help with their transition, and they're struggling enough as it is already. So the numbers are stark in terms of how many end up homeless, how many end up back on public assistance in some way, how many end up unemployed. Very few, you know, go to even start college, and many don't even finish high school. And really alarming numbers end up involved in the criminal justice system. And one of the points I try to make is this idea of connectivity, right? Is when a foster child is harmed, we're all harmed, and not just in a moral aspect, even though that's really important to me, but financially. When a child ages out of care and doesn't do well, and that child is more likely to be homeless or more likely to become involved in the criminal justice system, we all pay the price.
Mm-hmm. And you're talking a lot of money. Just looking, I believe, at foster care, are these figures correct that foster care agencies, through revenue maximization, have been allowed to take in over $250 million each year?
Right, and that number is probably low, you know, in terms of when that a federal look at this, and it was an estimate in terms of how many states are engaging this practice and how much they're taking from foster children, over $250 million annually that they're taking from children. And then when you talk about some of the other revenue maximization practices, like diverting Medicaid funds, we're talking billions. In terms of how much is being diverted.
Well, let's move into that. How are Medicaid funds being diverted?
Well, there's a whole host of ways. We can start with children again. Medicaid funds are targeted in a variety of different institutions, healthcare facilities that provide services, or sometimes schools. One of the examples that I write about in the book are that children, when they're poor and disabled, they can be eligible for school-based Medicaid funds. And that's a good thing. You know, like if a school system, even if they work with a contractor and go after these federal aid funds and then use those dollars to provide more services to these children who need more help, then I think that's great. But you're seeing some states that will engage in that practice or go after the Medicaid funds intended for poor disabled school children and then divert those funds from intended purpose. So New Jersey is one of the examples I write about in the book, where the state actually requires all the school districts to participate with a revenue contractor by the name of the Public Consulting Group, working to maximize the number of children who can be eligible for these school-based Medicaid claims and also the types of services that would be eligible for the claims, so trying to increase federal aid, these federal Medicaid dollars coming into the state.
Mm-hmm.
All those monies are supposed to be used by the schools to help provide for the care for the children, but instead, right in the budget documents, the Christie administration in New Jersey is diverting over 80% of those funds intended for poor disabled schools.
80%?
Over 80% to general state coffers. Wisconsin is diverting a good amount. Wisconsin, I think the number is around 40% that are diverted to general state coffers.
Really? How do you get all this information? If we were to do a thorough study in Wisconsin, we would just do Freedom of Information Act?
It can be. You know, some information is some states are pretty bold. You know, it's right up on budget documents that can be found either online, you know, or doing a little bit of legal research. They're pretty readily available. Other pieces of information I have obtained through state Freedom of Information Act requests. It is a challenge state by state. It's different in each state in terms of the transparency of the practices and also the budget documents, right, in terms of how transparent
sure.
the budget process is. And then some of this happens at the state level and some of it happens at the county level. So it can be tricky to follow the money.
Yeah. Would you say that there are any states at all that are wonderful exceptions to this, Daniel?
Well, all states, unfortunately, are doing some bad stuff. But there are some states that are doing some really good things as well in terms of using, you know, that will work to maximize school-based Medicaid claims and then use those monies as intended, right, not diverting the funds away from the children. So,
yeah.
You know, that's a good thing. But the problem is, you know, I think we've reached a point where our state agency leaders have just lost sight of their way. You have a subversion of purpose, right, where you have agencies that exist to serve the public welfare, to maximize the public welfare, and particularly for those vulnerable populations, are instead setting their sights on maximizing revenue, and when that's happening, harm results.
Right. Well, doesn't the federal government, because the money is earmarked, say, for schools, for Medicaid, or for Medicaid, to put 40% or 80% of those funds designated by the federal government, our tax dollars, to Medicaid, and then having it be used for highways or whatever, shouldn't that be illegal in some way? Doesn't the federal government have oversight?
I think that's a wonderful question, and there's a lot of different layers to that, depending on the type of aid that we're talking about. Sometimes I think these practices are arguably illegal, like with the practice of states taking resources from foster children. I've brought challenges to that practice, where I think one of the simplest legal arguments to understand is a breach of fiduciary obligation, because the state, when it acts as representative payee, takes over control of a child's money. That's a fiduciary relationship where the state has to use those funds in the best interest of the child beneficiary, but they're instead taking the money from children. With Medicaid, there have been efforts by the federal government, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and there have been audits, including by the General Accounting Office, to look at these practices and to try to reel it in. Sometimes it's a matter of where the states will stay ahead, you know, of the federal government. As the federal government has tried to clamp down on one practice, they'll come up with another. And in some of the practices, there's been some vagueness about whether or not states can do this, and sort of like the federal government may be aware, but has not been clamping down as hard as I think it should be doing, in large part because we haven't been aware.
Right. For-profit nursing homes sedating the elderly with psychotropic drugs in order to reduce staffing needs. Also use of the same kind of drugs for children in foster care and juvenile detention facilities. Pharmacies profiting by this. Doctors being aware of this.
It's a huge, huge concern on so many levels, you know, both with when you have, you know, the profit motive entering these services that are supposed to be providing for the public good, and when you see that can cause conflict with that aim to maximize the public welfare. But you're seeing some really stark examples, as you mentioned, both with nursing homes and with sometimes juvenile facilities, whether it be group homes and foster care or juvenile detention facilities, where the organizations, and some of these are nonprofits, so some are for-profit, whether they be nursing homes or the juvenile facilities, are sedating their residents, you know, using psychotropic medications for off-label uses because the residents are essentially cheaper for them. They're easier to manage. They don't have as much staff, so it increases their profit and revenue.
And you also highlight this. I guess sometimes we think we hear about this news story, and we heard about it in relation to Ferguson, where so much of the city's income was coming from targeting poor people with fines for various things, low-income defendants. How do courts partner with private collection agencies and others? And tell us about some of the more egregious examples of people who are dirt poor, who can't pay their fines, what some judges unbelievably have told them they had to do.
Sure. So how this is happening, and it's happening across the country, you know, often at the county level, where the courts have been brought into this process of becoming a revenue generator. Often partnering with private companies who would do the collection efforts or run the parole offices. They make the electronic monitoring devices, you name it. But it starts often with court fines and fees. It can come from a civil case or a minor criminal misdemeanor type of case. And there might be, a few hundred dollars owed. But a few hundred dollars owed by somebody who's very low income that's struggling to pay rent every month, that can put them over the edge where they can't afford to pay that right away. And if it starts to add up, the court is almost immediately adding on more fees, turning it over to a collection agency who will add on upwards of 35% on top of the amount owed. So a few hundred dollars quickly becomes $3,000, $4,000 owed by a low-income litigant. Some courts are jailing litigants for inability to pay often what's a civil fine. You know, this is the return of debtors' prisons. And some states there have been some increasing reports that have looked at this, and some courts have become aware and said, look, we need to not be jailing people just because they're poor. But that hasn't stopped the practice of the courts still going after these fees, right? And what's happening, sometimes those fees that are collected, sometimes those go to the courts. In some counties, they'll actually take those funds away from the courts and go to the county general coffers. So you have courts that have been brought into play, you know, with this general revenue maximization scheme in which the poor litigants are used as a practice. And like you mentioned in the introduction, as a unfortunate example, you know, like a judge that even told litigants you should go across the street and sell your blood if you can't afford to.
Well, I have a feeling the audience is going to want to respond to this, and there is much more to come. Daniel Hatcher is author of The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens. Daniel is professor of law at the University of Baltimore. He started his career with legal aid, and he represented over 300 children in the foster care system. And we're welcoming your phone calls. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. We're interested in your comments on Facebook as well, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, we have many fall calls coming in, and our guest is the author of The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens. Daniel Hatcher is with us, and let's go to Mary in Milwaukee first. Hi, Mary.
Good afternoon. Thank you for bringing this to light. Oh, my God, this is just blood boiling. Of course, we all know that they've been doing this to the industrial prison complex, has been taking advantage of the poor for many, many, many years, and I just keep asking myself, what kind of a civilized society are we?
I think that's a great and hard question. I have hope that most of us, when we become aware of these practices, will have the same feeling as you just expressed, you know, outrage. So I am hopeful that with increased awareness, we can work together to change these practices. And actually, there's been some movement in that direction. There's I've worked with a congressman's office out of Illinois, Danny Davis, who's introduced legislation within the last couple of weeks, that if it were acted upon, would protect foster children's survivor and disability benefits. So I'm hopeful, but I think we need to go a long way to try to increase awareness of these practices.
We had an email, somebody wondering why foster children can't sue the state once they get older, and it makes me think of a second question. How did Alex find you, or you find Alex, so he could sue?
Great questions. So it's sort of yes and no is the answer. So there are claims, and I brought a claim on behalf of Alex, and Alex was referred to me by a court-appointed special advocate. It was an advocate in Maryland who had worked with him, and it actually saw some prior writings I had done about this issue and reached out to me. And then, so the challenge, both with Alex and to answer the question, is that in many states, for somebody to bring a claim against a state government, there are state tort claims acts that allow that, but there is a very tight, usually, statute of limitations. And that came up in the Maryland case on behalf of Alex, where we filed this complaint. I filed this complaint on his behalf. And the state, the foster care agency, actually argued that Alex should have brought his claim within 1 year of when the claim arose. And they argued that would have been within 1 year of when they started taking his money, which was about age 14. So he's 14 in foster care. He didn't know they were even taking the money, and his advocates didn't know they were taking the money, but the state says, regardless, you should have filed your claim within 1 year before you started taking it. And the court upheld that, unfortunately, and dismissed his complaint. So there's a challenge. But there can be claims brought if people become aware while this is happening. There could be civil claims. You could also bring challenges to try to change who is the representative payee for a child in foster care, and that could be done at the agency level with the Social Security Administration. And then if anybody else is the representative payee, the state couldn't force that other organization or individual to pay over the funds to the state.
Somehow I can't imagine all of these people who are in the business of the child's well-being, the benefit of the child, taking all this money that belonged to this child and to many hundreds or thousands of other children and using it for something else and opening the door and saying, here you go, you're on your own when you're 18 years old, and I'm sorry, you don't have any money, and I'm not going to tell you that I took all of your money. Doesn't anybody have a heart?
Right, and how is this practice rationalized? Well, to start with, I want to point out, I try to make this this point as often as I can, is that these practices are happening, you know, high up at the state leadership level of the agencies and at the governor's office level. I think most frontline caseworkers are trying their best to do great work, and they care for their clients, and they want to provide excellent service, and they're often, unfortunately, underpaid and overworked. So it's happening much higher up. Some of the arguments, you know, on that issue of taking resources from foster children, that the agencies will argue, well, look, we're paying, the state is paying for the costs of foster care, and that's expensive. So the agency argues we should be able to take these funds from the children to pay ourselves back. I'm concerned, you know, first, I don't think foster children should have to pay for their own foster care, right? And then also, children have no debt obligation to pay for their own care. So there are some real legal concerns with what the agencies are doing. And when you back up, you know, I think, again, the agencies are losing sight of their purpose in their search for funds. They're so cash-strapped, they're so desperate for funds that they're forgetting that their sole reason for existing is to serve and protect foster children in their care. How could that mission possibly be furthered when they're taking the children's resources?
Right. Mary, thanks very much for your call. Let us go to Mike in Dubuque. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
I had a registration ticket recently and sat in a courtroom to talk to a judge about it. And, you know, everybody talks pretty loud. And I was counting the amount of money that was going through that place in one day. Most of the people had a hard time paying for their fines. And I multiplied it by the number of days the court's open to hear those traffic cases, and that's a lot of money going through, and most of the people, like I said, they're poor.
I think that's a great point, and it is a lot of money, although it's a lot of money that's owed, right, in terms of how much is coming through, and some people will pay there on the spot, you know, if they're able to afford to pay, and then sometimes they can result in a reduced fine, or sometimes if it's criminal misdemeanor charge, that can even result in reduced charges that way if they can deal with it right off the bat. But those who can't, it keeps adding up. So there's huge numbers of debt then that the courts are pursuing owed by these poor litigants, much of which often is never collected because the litigants are poor. And it's causing some severe harm, you know, not just in owing more money, but it goes on their credit report, and it's yet another burden, you know, that might take priority of their payment when they can't make ends meet to pay rent. They may have children that they're trying to support. If it's a absent parent who's trying to pay child support, it comes into conflict with that. So it just creates this domino effect of harm to the poor litigants, as you indicate.
And I guess I had one other question. There are people that I know who, their children are in not the best situation, they're separated or whatever, but they've heard such horror stories about the foster care industry that they would prefer they stay in a not good situation than go to a much worse one.
Right. Unfortunately, you know, our foster care agencies are underfunded in this country and are often not providing the level of services that children need. So, you know, I do agree with the agencies that say they need more funds. Right? You know, like our federal government, our state should be funding these agencies better so they can provide better care, either to stop the need of foster care in the first place, right, to provide better support for low-income struggling parents so they can better care for their children. There's no need for foster care for those children, or to provide better services when the children come into care. So more aid is, more funds are needed to these agencies, but I just don't think the agencies should be trying to fund themselves by taking resources from children.
And you don't believe that there should be a cut to these? Obviously, what's happening here is an indication that many of these agencies need more money to do their job lawfully and with good hearts.
Right, you know, both with foster care and with the Medicaid funds, you know, I think very much that the book does not provide support for arguments to cut aid funds, whether it be Medicaid or other types of funds. You know, if you have a state, you know, a governor that's diverting, misusing aid funds intended to help vulnerable populations, the answer isn't to cut that aid that's needed for the vulnerable. The answer is to stop the misuse.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk a little bit more about these private contractors. Is it the agencies themselves that are contracting with these private agencies to see if they can claim more disability and survivor benefits as government revenue? Is it the state that's doing that? And who are these companies? And how much money are they making?
It's both. It's and a lot. So sometimes the contracts are with the agencies directly. Sometimes it's with the state level. Either way, you know, so the results are sometimes the same. Especially when you're dealing with these issues with the contracts to obtain foster children's resources, and the companies are making lots and lots of money off of this. And that's in part why I think you've seen this increase in what are called revenue maximization contractors who are developing expertise in how to locate and maximize these various sources of aid funds, and then they get paid. Often they might take a cut of the aid funds that they claim through a contingency fee or some other flat fee incentive structure that's somewhat like a contingency fee. So there's a lot of money involved. I will say, you know, I think with that, you know, I've in some of the documents that I've seen with these revenue contracts, there's some really concerning language. You know, like I mentioned, the Maryland contract that described children as revenue generating mechanisms. But at the end of the day, it's the states, right? It's the state leaders, the leaders of the human service agencies, and the governors who are then deciding once the aid funds are maximized. It's the state leaders who are then diverting those aid funds from intended purpose. So that's where the core responsibility lies.
We go to Ann in Monona. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Well, I guess it's obvious to everyone, but so many states are in a financial crunch when they really don't need to. As Michael Moore said, the country is just rolling in dough. And how can we get our politicians to stop taking essentially bribes from private companies like the ones that are running prisons and force the rich, the super rich, the unbelievably rich, to pay their fair share of taxes? Because if that happened, it seems to me there wouldn't be a problem. The states wouldn't be in any financial trouble at all.
Is that the answer, Daniel?
Well, so she's the caller is hitting on the question of, like, states are cash strapped, and it's not because they can't raise sufficient revenues, it's that they're choosing not to, and a lot of that is because of the political landscape across the country. And again, both in red states and blue states alike, states have not been willing to increase revenue, to raise revenue through general taxation, you know, through a fair way, in order to fund government. And look, we live in a complicated society, and we need to fund government to provide core services that individuals need. So states still need to operate, so they're looking for money elsewhere, you know, and then taking money from vulnerable populations. There has been, you know, I think, again, with increased awareness and increased in pressure from the public when we become aware and better press coverage for this, I mean, just like this show, you know, I'm thrilled to have the opportunity to get the word out, that can increase pressure to hopefully improve things. There has been a step in the right direction at the federal level, where you mentioned privatized prisons. You know, the federal government has indicated it's going to stop renewing or starting new contracts with private companies in terms of federal prisons and detention centers. So I hope that happens, and if it does, that's a step in the right direction.
And thank you. Donald in Detroit. Hi.
How you doing?
Good, Donald. How are you?
I'm doing fine. I have witnessed Dearborn, Michigan. When you get a ticket in Dearborn, Michigan, they bring them up 10 at a time. And the judge usually sends out a $1,000 ticket to everybody, puts you on probation, and you have to pay $25 a week until your payment is, you know, they tell you that that's for the good of the city, but majority of the poor people who actually get stopped over in Dearborn are people who, you know, don't know that you're in Detroit and you're getting stopped by a Detroit cop. I mean, by a Dearborn cop. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. And what are the tickets for? $1,000? What's the payment for, Donald?
You could have the guy will write you a light, broken light, a blinker, not turning a blinker.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the things that Dearborn, you know how you ever seen where when you get stopped, you show ID. Not in Dearborn. You can just say any name, and Dearborn would accept it. So then you get stopped, and you go to court, and you says, I haven't been in Dearborn. I have not got a ticket. But you have these little communities. There's a cash thing now. They're strapping for money. And if you bring four or 500 people a week at $1,000, you're making $50,000 for that city.
Yeah, righto.
No, I think those are excellent points. You know, these are huge numbers of people who are brought into the court systems. Like you said, sometimes it's parking, driving fines, or having a broken taillight and the like. And then that adds up. If that individual can't pay quickly, $1,000 quickly becomes $3,000 or $5,000, and they become stuck. And then the court system may be working with private contractors to collect. And it's also harming the courts, right? Because the courts, they're supposed to exist to impart justice, you know, to decide important cases that impact the public good. And when they're crowded with these cases where they're instead in a revenue-seeking function, it takes away their capacity to spend sufficient time on cases like they should.
What was the figure again from Ferguson, the amount of money that the city was collecting with a percentage of their budget that came from just such fines?
I don't remember that percentage, but there's alarming percentages of how much money that's happening with this. And what's striking, too, is like some of the jurisdictions that are then, if the individual has the fines that have added up and then they can't afford to pay, if the courts will actually jail them. There's been some numbers that have looked at this where the counties and the courts that are doing this are then spending more money in that process, because it's expensive to have somebody sure. in the prison system, than they could ever collect. So some of it, like, they'll go out there in this revenue-generating function, but they also bring with that the punishment idea, and they're causing harm to themselves at the same time that they're causing harm to the poor litigant.
Yeah. And what about this judge who said, go sell your blood to pay your fine? Can a judge even say that?
Well, a lot of judges will say, unfortunately, just about anything they want to, and sometimes it's caught and sometimes it's not in terms of whether it gets reported. I used to practice in the Baltimore courts and the child support and paternity docket, and this is something that I write about in the book as well in terms of how much of what mm-hmm. we call child support is actually taken from children, again, to turn child support into a revenue source, but just huge crowded dockets, and the people are brought in, and I would hear judges tell people, you know, you just have to go out and do whatever you want, really treat them with disdain, and then, you know, the individuals are trying, you know, but then they're in a situation where they just can't make ends meet, and I saw individuals locked up, you know, lose a job because they were behind on a payment of something called child support that was actually owed to the government, not even owed to the children.
Mm. And then you're forever behind because you're locked
our
up.
Licenses would be suspended. You know, I had a client once who, you know, he was trying to be a truck driver and his license suspended. So, you know, if you can't drive, you can't work. So then you can't pay your support and everybody's harmed.
Yeah. Our guest this hour is the author of The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens. Daniel Hatcher is a professor of law at the University of Baltimore. He has represented many of these people in court. He started his career as a legal aid lawyer representing children in Baltimore from the foster care system, and their money had been taken from them. Survivors benefits, SSI, etc. Our phone number, join us. Our lines have been crowded, but there are some openings right now. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. The book is about all kinds of revenue schemes that target the poor. It's not confined to just a few jurisdictions. It's states and municipalities all over the country working with private contractors who've turned a range of vulnerable populations into sources of income for agencies that may be cash-strapped agencies for general funds and for corporate coffers. More phone calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Before we go back to phone calls, Daniel, this is such a horrendous situation all over the country. What do you recommend? What needs to take place in terms of reform?
Well, that's a huge, important question, and again, a lot of layers to that. You know, as we started the conversation, I think the largest thing that needs to happen is increase in awareness, right? And in order for any problem to be fixed, first we need to be aware of that problem in terms of the scope of it. So I'm hopeful that that will increase. And then as we become more aware, we can try to hold our government leaders, especially our leaders of our state human service agencies that exist to serve vulnerable populations, to hold them to their mission. So, you know, there's a lot of, and I write about in the book, a lot of the solutions that can happen either through regulatory change, some statutory changes, there can be some litigation. But it's really fairly simple in terms of the mission matters. You know, when you have Medicaid funds that are generated and intended to provide Medicaid services, those funds should be used to provide Medicaid services. Right, so as we become more aware, we can hopefully encourage and apply pressure that our agency leaders use those funds as intended, and also hold the federal government accountable for holding the states accountable, right? You know, so the federal government can do a better job of making sure that aid funds are used the way they're supposed to be used.
Yeah. All right, let's go to Tony in Ironwood. Hi, Tony.
Hi. Listen, I'm going to pose a question. I'll take my answer off the air. I'm old enough to collect Social Security, and I'm getting my Social Security. And I also have minor children that I'm raising. I take care of them. I pay all their bills and everything. And the Social Security benefits extend to them. There are checks that come in their names, and they're put in my account. And you know, it seems to me that it's not very much. I'm sure the state getting some similar amount as a survivor benefit certainly uses it up on the necessities of raising that child. So two questions. It's like, am I being unethical? Should I put all the children's benefit in a bank account separate for them? Or are you possibly suggesting the state should be doing that for these? I know they're unfortunate children, but, you know, my children, too. We just use the money that we have for the necessary things of life. So do you understand my question?
I do.
Is the state obligated to put that money aside and then hand them a nest egg when they're 16 or 18?
I think it's a wonderful question, and I do understand. So what you're describing is when you have a parent or a relative who may or may not be a representative payee, and you describe there's different types of Social Security benefits that might come in on the child's behalf, sometimes it's through the parent, if the parent is disabled or survivor benefits if a parent has died, or the child's own benefits based on the child's disability, right? When that money comes into a household and the parent is then using the money to help the household, the child benefits because there's more money coming into the household where the child lives, right? When the state is engaged in this practice, the child receives no benefit, right? So the disability benefits or the survivor benefits, those belong to the child. They're supposed to be used to benefit the child, but the child receives no additional funding, no additional services at all. No additional monies are going into the household where the child lives to provide for that care. And what I stated earlier, even the agency in these practices, even the agency itself often isn't benefiting because in most states, the states are reducing funds to the agency based upon how much money that the agencies take from the kids. So this not helping the kids, not helping the agencies, is strictly about savings to the state.
We haven't talked about this area at all. Let's at least mention it. Hospice care, targeting patients who may not actually be dying in order to maximize profits from government aid.
Right. So, I mean, there's some examples, and there's been some news stories about that in the past. You know, one, and it's yet another example of how, like, in the book, I'm covering a lot of different revenue maximization strategies, but I'm really just scratching the surface in terms of how much this is happening. So when you have, you know, a hospice agency or organization that, again, has this mission, you know, right, and they're focusing more on the profit rather than on the care and the quality of care, then harm results, right? You know, like, you know, when we're supposed to be maximizing public welfare, that needs to be the focus, not maximizing revenue. And it's just example after example, unfortunately, where this is occurring.
800-486-8655. Tony, thanks for your call. Andrew in Muskego is next. Hi, Andrew.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that I'm kind of behind the ball on this, but I just wanted to say that going back to the idea of, you know, you guys saying that it's a tough system out there and everything like that for people, you know, with jobs and everything. And although I completely agree with that and I completely agree with your guest, I will say that, you know, also I think that there is a mentality nowadays that people aren't work or don't want to work two or three jobs. And although sometimes that's not a good thing, sometimes it just has to be done. And I come from a long line of family members that had to do, you know, foundry work, and then they got off and then they went to the farm, you know. And I mean, it was just, that was the way it was to make ends meet. And it was terrible, and it wasn't the best way to do things and the best family life, but that's what had to be done. And, you know, sometimes you just got to pull up your bootstraps and do it, even though it's not the greatest thing to do. So, you know, I just wanted to make that comment, and it's a great show. Thank you very much.
I appreciate the comments, and you know, I think it raises a good point as well, is that, you know, I think we all should debate the best structure of these aid programs, the various programs. You know, this kind of comes from the caller's comments. You know, like sometimes, like, we all have to try hard, you know, in order to improve ourselves. So I think it's good to have discourse about how to best structure our aid programs, you know, and from the various political viewpoints, and whether more should be done at different levels of government. So that debate's a good thing. This is what our country is all about, is have differing viewpoints and to have that discussion. But I hope that we should all be able to agree that when you have aid funds that are generated and intended for a specific purpose, whether they're Medicaid funds or foster care-related funds, Social Security benefits, those funds should be used as intended. Otherwise, you're subverting the core purpose of the programs that were created.
Are you making waves with the book, Daniel?
I hope so. I'm hopeful with some of the congressional interests. As I mentioned, the congressman out of Illinois who's introduced legislation. I'm hopeful with some of the response I've received, both from individuals and with policymakers, that people do care once they become aware that they both caring about, you know, back to the caller's point again, like, at least somebody should have a chance, right? You know, Alex, what I wanted for Alex, my former client, when he aged out of foster care, is at least have a chance to have that struggle that the caller talked about so he could really try, right? But it seems like to him, Alex is talking about, like, the whole world is against him. And, you know, I've been his lawyer and friend and a law professor, and it feels to me like often the whole world is against him. So I hope we can move better in that direction.
Mm-hmm. And also, you talk about how that was a connection, or would have been a connection, to his father. His father had put aside money for him, and then he couldn't have it, you know? And
right, I think that's a great point. You know, the survivor benefits that was earned by his father, so it's not that it would have provided the financial benefit for Alex, but he would have known that he would have had this money that his father left for him, right? Mm-hmm. So he could have used that money to help himself that was left to him from his deceased father, and I think that could have had immense benefit for him.
And there's another whole area worthy of another whole book, is why is it that we are totally neglecting all of these children who are aging out of foster care?
Absolutely right. I think it's a national shame scandal in terms of how we're not helping children when they leave care. Nursing home quality of care in our country is something that is not discussed nearly enough. You know, the care for our older Americans is unfortunately not good on average in this country. And then when those nursing home facilities that are supposed to be providing good care for older Americans are then used to leverage additional federal aid that's routed from the struggling residents, right, to instead the general state coffers, we need to change those practices.
Why is it that when you look at this historically, we do target those who just can't speak up very easily? They're too young or they're too sick. They're young and they're old, and that's who we're targeting.
Right. Well, and unfortunately, often those of us, I mean, I think we're all vulnerable, right? And I use the terms vulnerable a lot in a book, but ultimately we're all vulnerable and we're all connected and we're all interdependent both upon each other and on the government systems that are intended to serve us. Unfortunately, often those of us who are the most vulnerable have the smallest or the quietest voice, right? They don't have the level of voice within the political sphere in order to spur change and to let others know what's happening. So I hope that we all can help with that practice of increasing the voice of those among us who are the most vulnerable.
Well, you've done your part. Thank you, Daniel, so much for being with us. It's really an important book.
Thank you so much.
Hope you make a lot of waves.
Thank you so much.
Daniel Hatcher, the book is The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens. Daniel is a professor of law at the University of Baltimore, and he has represented well over 300 of foster care children whose money designated for them was used for other purposes. Thanks to Scotty Myers and KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks everybody for listening. We will be with you again tomorrow. And we'll be talking this hour of the show about the Thomas Benton exhibit and what a history behind that that's currently at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Thank you for listening.